Greetings, film freaks. We are the Podcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema. Season 2.
What's poppin', people? Welcome to the Podcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in your ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
I used to think it was saving his life from this warm sausage tea.
On today's episode, we will be talking about Killers of the Flower Moon. This is a 2023 film directed by Martin Scorsese and stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, and Lily Gladstone. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. When oil is discovered in 1920s Oklahoma under Osage Nation land, the Osage people are murdered one by one, until the FBI steps in to unravel the mystery. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
We bleed for their greed. Bad deeds, then we die. Their pockets we feed. We suffer, my tribe. Planting their seeds. In us then they try to take what is ours. Move in then goodbye.
Then goodbye, then goodbye. Kill my tribe, kill my tribe. Then goodbye, then goodbye. Kill my tribe.
Oil rich, but treated poor. If roles were reversed, we'd be no more. A plague on our lands, a curse on our people. We're in high demand. Their kindness is lethal.
Kill my tribe, kill my tribe. Then goodbye, then goodbye.
Let's start with some facts about the film. Martin Scorsese said that when he read David Grand's book, Killers of the Flower Moon, he knew that he had to make it into a movie. Scorsese spent several hours together with Chief Standing Bear to convince the Osage Nation to help with the filming.
That's cool.
Shout out to Chief Standing Bear. Mm-hmm. What a name.
I think Lily Gladstone said as well that it changed the film involving the Osage people. So the film was one vision.
Mm.
And then by involving the Osage people, he actually changed the film for the better, they said. I would still would have liked to have seen the original without the input of the Osage people and see how he interpreted the text without getting any help from the native.
Yeah, I think a film like this requires to have at least some input from those that were, well, they're not going to be directly affected, but have the ancestry, the heritage comes from those people that were affected. I think it's important to get a sense of a culture, lifestyle, what's important to those specific group of people.
Yeah.
And I just like that him, Chief Standing Bear and Chieftain Director Man united to tell this story. I quite like that.
It adds to the grittiness, the realism.
Mm. Robert De Niro was irked by Leonardo DiCaprio's frequent ad-libbing. According to Martin Scorsese, every now and then, Bob and I would look at each other and roll our eyes a little bit, and we tell him, you don't need that dialogue.
Why was he doing that?
I love that you've got a younger pup like DeCap going, like playing, going, oh, I want to do it like this, why don't I do this? And you've got two old dogs that are like, no, just calm down. Leo, calm down. We're doing it like this. We don't need your improv. This is how we're doing it.
Wow. Did any of them stay in the film, do you know?
I'm not sure. I know, like, Scorsese's he's renowned for being quite to the letter. He's not really, from what I've heard about him, I don't know the bloke. From what I've heard, he likes it to be quite, no, these are your lines.
Yeah.
Okay. And some directors are the complete polar opposite. Like, they like run with it, go with how you think, but he's very by the book.
I think Ridley Scott's a bit like that. He likes people to, I mean, if they do experiment with their own words,
yeah,
go for it if it works. But,
But DiCaprio is like the Scorsese's De Niro of recent times, isn't he? They've collaborated loads together. So you'd think by now DiCaprio would be like, you know, Daddy Scorsese doesn't like it when I dance on my own.
I think it showed, you know, especially if he did it in that scene in the car when De Niro and DiCaprio have just found out that the guy they've hired to kill the melancholy native Indian in this Henry, and they're in the car. De Niro's shouting about, why did he shoot him in the back of the head? Should have shot him in front of the head. It was supposed to be a suicide. And then DiCaprio turns and goes, you need to shoot him in the goddamn back of the head.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell was that? It's really out of place. That line delivery and everything to me was like, that was a bit weird. I wonder if that was one of the things that irked them.
I wouldn't be surprised, because he's got this sort of Ricky Gervais from Derek character. He's got like a, what do you call it, an underbite, where his bottom half of his jaw is more extended than the top. He has that sort of facial feature throughout. But in that scene you're talking, it's like he's goofing off for like an old school blooper that's going to be included in the extras.
Singed it.
But I didn't even clock that until you said, look at this bit, and sent it to me. And I was like, fucking hell. It's like he's playing a completely different character.
It was very strange. And he has his two front teeth. I think he's got false teeth in the film.
This character that he plays in this film is a little different to his normal characters. He's a little simple. His character, Ernest Burkhart, he's not the sharpest tool in the box, is he?
No.
And he's not necessarily really charming or charismatic. He's quite a simple Simon, it's fair to say.
The most unusual protagonist of a film, I think, that I've seen. Yeah.
It's an odd one, but I don't know about you. I did like seeing him in that slightly different role. And I love the thought of him being in a scene, maybe not in a scene with De Niro, and the old guard, Scorsese and De Niro, going, fucking hell, Leo's at it again. Like, no, no, no. What are you doing? Why are you ad-libbing? You know the rules. Stick to the textbook. Just love that.
Very weird character.
Yeah.
Strange.
The investigation into Osage County was the first investigation presented to the newly formed Federal Bureau of Investigation. It was led by J. Edgar Hoover. Now,
Caprio played him in a movie.
Yes, yes he did. Now that's an interesting fact, but isn't it such an American thing to do in a story where there is a indigenous group of people that are being mistreated, mishandled, exploited, all of these terrible things? Isn't it such an American thing to do, to be like, this is the FBI's first case, look at how good we were, we came in and stopped this?
Historically true.
Yeah, but that group of people is also the root of the problem, and the film focuses like FBI's coming to save the day. No, you need to be doing more to villainize those fuckers that screwed these people over.
Yeah, it seemed like in them times that they were obviously Native Indians considered second-class citizens. So the fact that it took how many deaths, like 20, before they even...
At least.
Before Plemons even put his jawline into the shot.
Yeah.
I think with Hoover, he was always trying to promote the FBI. He always wanted it to be taken seriously because it was a new thing. It was a new idea. So he needed big cases. He needed to get the abbreviation FBI into the world. You've got to strike fear into people.
I mean, it's quite a hefty case for the first one.
Mm.
So kudos to them for actually getting it sorted, I guess.
Didn't it start with John Dillinger, Public Enemy? I think FBI started by hunting down Dillinger, the bank robber, with the Tommy guns and the cars.
What Dillinger do? Bank rob?
I might have the name completely wrong, but yeah, Johnny Depp played him in a movie.
Public Enemies?
Public Enemy, yeah. I think he was a bank robber in Chicago.
Okay.
I think the FBI hunted that down. That was pre-World War II, I think.
Mm.
But yeah, this was a big case for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you like about Killers of the Flower Moon?
No expenses spared. No expenses spared?
Okay.
It looks wonderful.
Yeah, it does.
And filmed on actual location as well, which is a plus, I reckon.
Mm.
Absolute plus. I loved one of the early scenes of the Native Indians dancing around like an oil geyser. So it's the natural oil spilling from the ground. And it's slow motion. You can hear the drums, the rhythm, and they're doing this wicked native dance in slow motion around this blowing up of oil geyser. And I wanted the imagery of that to keep happening in the film.
Striking, isn't it?
Yeah, and it looked incredible. Everything was really crisp in this film. Very 4K digital looking, really sharp. And I just think he doesn't hold back. I mean, look at the street in it. It's like an old cowboy thoroughfare, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it just looks 100% real. The cars, the clothing, everything. He doesn't skimp ever.
Never. Yeah, I think, you know, Scorsese is one of the greatest to ever do it, in my personal opinion anyway. And he's got such a reputation now and such a repertoire that the man can be like, I'm making this film And whatever studio he's making the film for, they're like, all right. And he's like, I need this much money. They're like, okay, you're fucking Martin Scorsese. Of course you can.
Well, that's the only reason he can get away with 3-hour, 30-minute films.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and if nothing else, I don't know what your opinion is of this film. We haven't really spoken about it before pressing record. But like you say, but even if you absolutely hated the film for how it the story it's telling you, how it's told, any of those things, you can't deny that as a filmmaking feat, it's impressive. And the way it looks is definitely one of the biggest selling points, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's atmosphere over narrative, but that doesn't mean it's bad necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just, it's different.
Mm. I think films that are so long as well, they are tricky to do a podcast episode on, because there's so much ground covered. And like you say, when the film opens, and that's one of the first scenes, isn't it? It gives the audience a sense of they've basically struck gold. They've struck oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's coming up like a geyser, like a fountain, like huge, and they're dancing, and it's because they know that the value and stuff like that. It sort of sets the precedent for the rest of the film. And there's not one scene, there's not one beat that looks out of place. It's all an absolute feast for the eyes. And yeah, the ears as well. I think the music and the sound work on it is all quality as well.
Yeah.
What other things do you like about it?
Lily Gladstone, I think she's the movie's most compelling character for me.
Mm.
I think the film could be guilty of potentially telling the film from the wrong perspective.
Yeah.
Or not using the Osage characters in a way where we see like the real effect of what it did to them. I just felt like we should have seen it more from her perspective.
Yeah.
I think it would have been good if, in fact, a lot of the scenes actually started with her. And it was people like DiCaprio's character, who is, without being derogatory, a simpleton, you know, of the time. And De Niro's just this really devious, scheming piece of shit. I would have liked it if they were coming into the scenes because she started the scene.
Yeah.
Like, I would have preferred to have seen it from her perspective. I don't think she had enough screen time to warrant, like, a potentially winning any Oscar for it.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I'm glad you highlighted her as a positive, because I do think she was fantastic in
Brilliant.
This. But I don't think she was given enough to do. Like, that's something, I mirror that sentiment exactly. Like, this is the Osage people's story. It should only be seen from the Osage perspective. The FBI comes in later on, that's fine. But the story shouldn't be told by a husband who's not as sharp and isn't necessarily realizing how he's been manipulated by his little finger of an uncle.
He knew. He fucking knew.
I think he learns to know. I think he was slow on the uptake. It took him a while, and the longer it took him, the more he was falling in love. So he's I found him an interesting character, but you're right. This it should be only from Lily Gladstone's eyes and her family's eyes. They're the ones that are getting fucked over, and they're kind of secondary characters, which is really odd when the focus is showing the injustice dealt by these people, by DiCaprio, by De Niro, and how it impacted the Osage people.
Yeah, her surviving it is the focus for me. So I want her to survive it, so therefore it should have been told more from her perspective. It's very strange to watch a film where you're following the bad guys scheming for greed and pretty much winning for 98% of the film. It's so it's a strange experience. I think as a duo of bad dudes, De Niro and DiCaprio, if they were secondary to Lily Gladstone in this, their characters could have been far more interesting.
It's an interesting decision made by Scorsese. And in the fact section, we said that he had direct help by Chief Standing Bear to make this film and to tell their story. Maybe it was a joint decision by Chief Standing Bear and Scorsese to tell it from the villain's perspective, because it was the Osage people that were victims. So they wanted to shine more of a light on, look at how awful these people were.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look at how bad they were. And don't focus on our narrative. We know that we are the ones that struggled. Look how bad they were. Look at the facts of what they did, how awful these people are. Maybe that was a reason behind the decision. I don't know.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like maybe he wanted to just sober his audience to that time in history.
Yeah.
And how rotten it was. But I do think that makes the narrative struggle.
I won't go in it too much, but that is one of the things I disliked about it, is that narrative decision.
Mm.
But before we get there, have you got any more likes for me?
I got an oxymoron like.
I love me an oxymoron.
So it's a like and it will become a dislike. But I'll explain it anyway.
Hit me with your rhythm stick.
The tension was excellent in the opening third of the film, I found. It's accompanied by Robbie Robertson composed. Mm. He's worked with Scorsese before, and he died after this film.
Mm. Did he?
Yeah, the film, it had an honouring to him in it. But yeah, he composed lots of films with him, Silence, etc. I love his pace setting score. The way the film starts, it's like, oh, there's going to be big reveals in this. Yeah. There's going to be this and this. But it just keeps going until everyone we sort of care about is dead or dying or is in prison.
Yeah.
And there's still an hour to go after all of the biggest events in the film.
Yeah.
And that tension keeps going. But the problem is, when you watch this film, you're watching it from the perspective of the bad guys. You're aware of every scheme. Nothing happens by surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
You know they're going to bomb a house. The house doesn't blow up and then DiCaprio's like, what's going on? He knew.
Yeah, he's in on it.
So it's weird. The tension-setting music I adored in the opening third because I was excited. I thought, I'm sitting down for a big Scorsese 3.5 hour.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed The Irishman. Yeah. So I thought I'd be, I was overly excited for this film. Like, so much to the point, we almost had a fight because you saw it without me. And I was ready to pull knife and shank you.
We didn't almost have a fight. Like, we're the only reason it didn't come to physical blows is because we were 10 Guinness deep.
Yeah.
But it was, it just to paint a picture for the listeners, I sort of revealed to Harold that I'd seen this film in the cinema. And it felt like I was saying to a partner, listen, I got drunk and I cheated on you.
Well, we'll let them decide. But I've always had an issue with the fact that you say I watch films of my partner in the cinema. That's our thing. I'm like, we have a fucking film podcast together. Do you know how ridiculous that is?
Yeah. And me and the partner have spoken about this. An agreement, a treaty has been met.
Yeah.
We will, in the future,
yeah,
you and I will visit cinema for said podcast.
Just in time for all the shit films.
Yep. And she has to understand that the podcast means more to me than she does.
That is so cold.
That is so not true as well.
Yeah.
You done with your likes?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Should I go on to mine?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I liked about it, mate.
Go on.
I'll tell you. Big old double Ds.
Big dicks?
No. Not quite. Nothing tickles my pickle more than watching two big, juicy and full-bodied, brilliant actors share the screen together. I'm, of course, talking about DiCaprio and De Niro, the king and prince of cinema. I, for one, love seeing them share this cinematic space, and I enjoyed seeing DiCaprio play dim-witted and De Niro playing dangerous. I don't know about you, but it makes me happy to see Bobby get a substantial role, and DiCaprio is great value in absolutely everything he does. Now, De Niro's popped on my screen for Warburton's recently. Fucking bread that I can't digest, and Uber Eats, and to see him get a juicy role where he's got actually stuff to do, it just warmed my cockles.
Is he
just happy?
Short of money or something?
He can't be. He's like one of the biggest stars ever, unless it's about cementing security for his family and that, because he's getting into his twilight years.
So he's doing an advert for Warburton's bread, Uber Eats. So he technically, you could go on Uber Eats, order Warburton's grocery delivery of bread to your house.
Mm-hmm. And De Niro's had a digit in both of those dogs.
And if he delivers it.
If he delivered it.
That would be insane.
I would order it every day.
Why is he doing loads of adverts?
I don't know, but that's what I mean. That's why it's a like for me, because obviously DiCaprio's still highest billing. He's still peak of his powers. He's still A-list. Like, everybody wants a slice of DiCap.
Boy, if Daniel Day-Lewis was to do an advert, what would it be about?
Cheese.
No.
Strong British cheese.
He's very pro-Irish. I don't think he would be championing a British cheese.
Kerrygold butter.
Kerrygold butter.
Yeah.
From the man who starred in The Boxer, In the Name of the Father, yeah. My Left Foot.
For a butter as smooth as his
line delivery.
Oh, that was much better. Yeah, we'll go with line delivery.
Okay.
But that's a like for me, because I've seen De Niro in some really bad films recently, like straight to DVD at best films, where he pops up, he's doing like what a Morgan Freeman's doing now, and Andy Garcia or a Sly Stallone, but actors that, not to be rude, are past their sell-by date. He's done a lot of that, so seeing him in The Irishman, seeing him in this, where he's got a lot of heavy lifting to do, I like to see it. And whilst both characters played by DiCaprio and De Niro were largely unlikable, I did think they were both great in this one. I don't know if you tend to agree.
I don't know, again, if it's that thing where I can't separate the character from the actor.
Yeah, but you know Bobby D and Leo D by now, right?
I think Bobby D played a perfectly good bad guy in this. I wasn't overly enthralled with DiCaprio's character or performance. There was nothing I could pinpoint about it that I thought was great. His accent's been sort of used before in similar roles. I don't know, I just found him, it's a weird one.
So
maybe I didn't like him as a person, the character it was, but I just don't think there was nothing meaty in it about him. Because he didn't really have a conscience.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of it. You're right, because you'd have to be extremely, extremely dim, more than we're led to believe this character is, to have no idea what's going on around him. He has got an idea, at least an idea, of all the dodgy dealings dealt out by De Niro. But it would take, I don't know, I found his character captivating because he was in a sort of inner turmoil, because I do think he really loved his wife, but I also think he really loved the money, and I really think he didn't want to let his uncle down. So he was quite a complex character in that sense. He had a lot going on. He had a lot of inner turmoil and stuff. I thought he was good in it. It's not, don't get me wrong, if he was Oscar nominated, I don't think he is for Best Actor. If he was Oscar nominated, I don't think he deserves an Oscar for this. He's performed much better in much better films, but I still thought he was bloody good, personally.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't isolate his performance.
No.
Not for me, no.
Run-of-the-mill DiCaprio. We've seen him be good so many times, you want to see him a bit better.
Potentially, yes.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Second thing I liked about the film was Scorsese's storytelling. I could honestly watch this man direct a story about why my mum chose floral wallpaper to decorate her living room and be wholeheartedly engaged. Whilst I think this film was guilty of both being too bloated and leading with the wrong perspective narratively, I was fully engrossed in a film that seemed like a passion project from one hell of a great director.
Yeah.
So, honestly, the man could make a film about anything, and if I see his name linked with the film, I'm a watch it.
What would that be called?
And I'm a joy it. Enjoy it.
The film about your mum's floral wallpaper.
Deliverer of the flower paper.
Decisions in style.
Mm.
Decisions on style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd still watch it.
Yeah, I would.
I could watch him. I could honestly watch his story about anything and probably enjoy some aspect of it. He just knows what he's doing.
He doesn't do anything he doesn't love, does he? So, and that shows through the films he produces.
Yeah.
There's love. Even if you don't enjoy the film, you can see there's absolute love in it.
I had a question about Scorsese. Can you think of him ever doing a sequel? I can't think of a time where he's handled a project that's been more than one film.
I don't think he has. Some bastard out there probably says, oh, it's a companion piece, which basically means it's unrelated.
Yeah.
Probably not. I don't think so.
Mm.
Imagine that. Imagine if he did a sequel to Goodfellas.
Or Silence 2.
Yeah.
Even quieter.
Even quieter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Final thing I liked about it was it's just educational and entertaining. And you know me, I love to be taught things through the medium of film. I'd no idea about the injustice and despicable dealings faced by the Osage people, and Killers of the Flower Moon gave me insight into a shocking yet not so surprising true story of American greed. Pair this with a great cast, immense cinematography from Rodrigo Prieto, and an atmospheric soundtrack from Robbie Robertson, and you have a well-made, well-handled, and well-crafted film that manages to be both enlightening and engaging. Now, I will caveat that with, it is a very long film. It is a film that demands that you sit there and you basically have to give up a whole day for it, because it's fucking long. But when at any time I see, like, I'm a huge Scorsese fan, I'm a huge fan of De Niro, huge fan of DiCaprio, and I think that boosts the score up for this for me before even seeing it. Like, there's so many things going for it that it's going to have to do something pretty awful for me not to enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a staple of your diet, isn't it?
It's exactly that. Yeah.
You can have, say you love porridge, you love it.
I have it every day.
You can have porridge that's quite mediocre some days. You get a little bit of honey in there, a little bit better. A few nuts in there, a bit more better. Some little pieces of dark chocolate. Porridge, if you like it,
you're going to like
it. You can play around with it. You're going to like it going in regardless.
Well, it's like pizza, isn't it? Mm. Even a shit pizza is better than no pizza.
Yeah, that is a famous saying as well. Even bad pizza is still pizza.
Socrates first said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What didn't you like about Killers of the Flower Moon?
Actually, I want to go back to what you said about American greed.
Okay.
We started all that shit, pretty much. Got to remember that. We put a foothold in North America with the 13 colonies. We started it.
We're the arseholes.
We started it, they finished it. So you've got to always include yourself whenever it comes to being, you know, derogatory towards the Yanks.
Adam's an arsehole?
No, I'm just saying, like, the governments or the people that are after the greed, that's not unique to Americans.
Yeah. No, that's a good point well made. It's important that we're not just Yank bashing.
Yeah, we first got there and tried to subjugate.
And I think if you listen to the podcast enough, you know we also have great problems with the British.
Oh, huge.
We're arseholes.
Huge.
Yeah. Ready for dislikes, Dad?
I am.
Go.
Robbie Robertson's pace setting score.
Oh, here's that oxymoron.
Is that oxymoron?
Yeah.
So again, keeps going when we know all the dastardly plans and everyone is like dead or caught. I would personally, after the schemes have all been done, I would have gone with a sorrowful fiddle for the last hour.
A sorrowful fiddle.
Right, yes, a sorrowful fiddle. That would have been my ting. It's a small dislike, but it just, when you're really aware now that that pace setting score is still going.
Yeah.
You're like, what the f-?
It doesn't change, does it?
Fudge is that?
It does peak, but you're right. When that suspense is filled and there's no longer suspense, we're now just dealing in consequences. It's still got that same beat. That same, like, unnerving, like, almost like Jaws-esque, that yes. Very simple beat.
Heartbeat.
From a bass, yeah. It doesn't change.
Could be intentional.
Yeah.
Could be a message saying, like, this still demands reparations. This is still a horrific crime. And by maybe not talking about it or people not knowing about it, maybe you should still feel tension over it.
Yeah, do we...
But that is a deep dive.
Yeah. Do we know if he did a dead before the film finished? Because if he
this
did...
This was the last film he scored.
Oh, so he had finished...
He finished the scoring.
He finished the scoring.
And then died.
Oh, okay.
Because I think it was while he was watching it.
Mate, well, it's take that. It's that fucking long.
3.5.
It might have, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I thought maybe that the reason it doesn't change is because he did a dead halfway through and couldn't finish it. So
that's hilarious.
But yeah,
just keep it running.
Yeah, keep it going. Yeah, he's no longer with us. But no, that's sad news. I like what he did in this film.
Second dislike. It's for me. It's a grind watching arsehole scheme for 3.5 hours.
Yeah, it is.
But now that some of the time's like sort of passed. I mean, I used and I did the maths. 0.00532% of my life, if I live to 75, watching this film.
Fuck me.
I might be guilty of this, I may have potentially watched it incorrectly. And if I may quote filmmaker Alfonso Cuarón, he put, Scorsese has chosen a distant and reflective stance, favouring atmosphere over narrative, denying us the easy satisfaction of moral superiority to the men on screen who manage to justify their hideous betrayals of their loved ones and still pretend to have a soul, and confronting audiences with the sin by omission that must rightfully haunt the American soul. So I read that after I watched it and I thought I might be guilty of watching it incorrectly. Is there such a thing?
I understand what you're saying. And that's an astute observation from Mr. Cuarón.
Mm.
Maybe I might be guilty of being right there with you because I can't sort of withdraw myself from thinking that the narrative perspective was wrong. But maybe if I'm watching it already thinking that, I'm only damaging my own experience of it, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, it's a very new way for me to see a film, like the way they've delivered the film. Like, it's so true what Alfonso Cuarón said, like, it's atmosphere over narrative.
Yeah.
And I felt that throughout, and that's why it did feel like a grind. It did feel long. Oh, do you want to know how long you've spent of your life watching it?
I was thinking that because I've seen this 3 times.
I did the maths. Oh, so this is based on you seeing it twice.
Okay.
So according to the calculator, so 7 hours is approximately 0.0001% of your life if you live to 75. It's cool, isn't it? I really enjoyed doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
It's not at all sinister.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, when you think about it, if that's the case, I've probably wasted a larger percentage of my life just scrolling on my phone looking at nonsense.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying I wasted my life. I'm just saying I spent
that
percent of my life watching this film.
But the idea of putting a percentage on how I've wasted my life is making me look really inward and being like, I've wasted a lot of it.
We can stop right now.
Should we have a cuddle?
We could stop right now and just call it. Go play some basketball or something.
Sounds good. Shoot some hoops.
Yeah.
Eat some ham.
If that weren't clear, my second dislike literally was I think potentially I might have miswatched the film, but I also don't have the beans or the fuel in the tank to go back to it yet. I'd have to wait a long time.
It's not a tight 90 that you can chuck on just before bed and give it a fresh pair of eyes.
Sounded like tight 90.
Yeah.
90. Oh, shit.
Naughty boy. But yeah, no, I mean, that kind of ties into what I think. And now you saying that, maybe I watched it wrongly. I never even considered that as a thing, but it was so well put by Alfonso. Yeah, that's right. I'm on first name terms with the man.
Yep.
That maybe I'm guilty of that as well. I can say I'm not going to revisit it because I've watched it 3 times in the space of a year and I don't have the energy or emotional strength to do that again.
Cinema Uno.
Yeah.
Mi Casa Dos.
Yeah.
Dos. Okay. Yeah, definitely. That's a lot, man. That
I mean,
is a lot.
That's one of my dislikes, probably my biggest dislike. You know, I sound a bit like DiCaprio in this film, with a bit of a Simple Simon, but it was just too long. I've learned to love slow burning, long runtime films. Scorsese's last film, The Irishman, was 3.5 hours long, and I mopped that dog up with red wine and bread and absorbed every minute with great pleasure.
Oh.
But Killers of the Flower Moon, unfortunately, felt like it outstayed its welcome. The first and third act I actually thought were brilliant. It showcases textbook Scorsese build-up of tension and drama, but that sag in the middle just felt so hefty, and I would have liked some of that fat trimmed off. I understand this was a story that spanned a long period of time, but I couldn't help feel restless around the 2-2.5 hour mark. And I feel bad saying that. And your point has made me think maybe I'm the problem here. Maybe the film wasn't too long, because I had a great time with The Irishman. I danced with that dog all night long. I liked that.
I adore long films. I mean, if you sit me down with Bridger on a River Kwai or Lawrence of Arabia, there's an epic old charm to them that keep you there. But also, they're films where it was all about the reveal and the big action sequence. So it kept me in a lot more. Whereas this film, again, it's like you're watching a painting evolve. Yeah. I don't know. It was a weird feel, but I adore long films.
Yeah.
I would never criticize a film for its length. But this film, just what you said, the sag in the middle, it's my belly when I turned 30. The shit just dropped.
Hey now.
You're an all-star.
Yeah.
Get your game on.
But be kind to yourself, please.
All right, mate.
Because you're no Brendan Fraser from Whale, mate. You're like 17 less than that, so don't be so harsh.
That's not
right?
A fucking compliment.
Yeah, it is. 17 times less than
Cunt
a man.
Weighed about 65 stone. Well, you're saying I weigh 40 stone.
Mr. Math Man, put that in a percentage and see how much percentage lighter you are than Ponder Whale Man.
All right.
Yeah.
You got me there, mate.
Any more dislikes for thee?
Yeah. So I'm English.
You are.
So it's a bit of the pot calling the kettle black to say this, but I made the mistake of reading Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown a couple of years ago. And the most shocking thing in that book, which is echoed in this film, is how often the indigenous people, or the first Americans, were betrayed and fooled over and over again. They'd see like awful massacres on both sides. They did it as well, but obviously they weren't the instigator. But they'd always like sue for peace or accepted it once it was offered to them every single time. And every time it was offered to them, the goalposts would be moved. And they'd say, okay, we want peace. The Americans would say to like natives, we want peace. But now you've got to move your reservation or your hunting grounds 100 miles south of here to an arid land. And they'd accept it. And so every time they gave peace to the Western expansion in the States, every time they gave peace, they just kept giving up more and more land.
Yeah.
And what that meant was they'd get smaller and more concentrated, become reservations in the end. And watching this film, just the whole time I was watching it, I probably didn't enjoy it as much because I'd read this excellent, haunting book about how the Native Indians were treated. And, you know, essentially there was a genocide involved. And obviously, again, I'm English. This is not a diss on Americans. If anyone's guilty of horrific shit, we're one of the first.
It's good that you're highlighting that, yeah.
Well, I'm 100%, but every country has.
Yeah.
There ain't a country on earth you couldn't read their history and find out that whoever took power, whoever had more money, more men, didn't commit atrocities. It happens. Yeah, watching it, it just frustrated me again watching the Native Indians almost, I think the way they observe the world, and that's probably how I see it when it's portrayed in films, but having read a good book about them, it's almost like they want the world to be in harmony with nature. And that's almost a soft point. That's almost a way to attack them because they want harmony.
If you show a weakness, you bet your bottom dollar someone's going to exploit it.
And I think that's what's hard to... For me, it was hard to watch this movie because of that. I'm like, oh, God, how do you not know you're being done over again?
I mean, that's a solid point.
Don't put the hatchet down, man. Fuck it. Get obliterated, but go down fighting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not one to talk on the subject because my education is pretty much solely on this film and other films that are sort of dancing around this subject matter. But is this a case of it being patient zero? Is this the first time that they're dealing with the non-Native Americans and they got screwed over? Is this the first instance? So they didn't know any better. They trusted and then was...
Oh, God, no. No, you're going back to flintlock musket days.
Yeah.
Way back. So when the Spanish first landed in Central South America, they're also Native Americans, you know, the Incas, the Aztecs, all considered Native Americans.
Yeah.
Navajo, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Mohicans, all of them. They were tribes. It was a tribal nature, the hunter-gatherers, etc. So their history was rich. By the time this film happened, they were completely aware and knew of all the tragedies that had happened to their people.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the film, they're called incompetents. They're not even allowed to access their own money without a white person to do it for them.
So they've already been like degraded. They've already been subjected to being considered inferior.
Yeah, the only thing that protected them a bit in this film is that more laws have been established because it's World War One, isn't it? It's set after World War One. So, you know, America's complete. There's, you know, California's a part of America, Texas is a part of America. Mm. Law sort of governs the land. And it's just their luck that the oil was found on their tribal lands. So they had rights to the oil, head rights. And it's still, I think that's what bothers me more in watching it. I'm like, 300 years before this, you were getting done over by the colonials.
Yeah.
So the French and the British. And then the Americans gained their independence. And then you let it happen through the Americans when they were expanding west.
Yeah.
You know, and now America's no longer expanding west or, you know, looking for gold and doing all that stuff and creating California Republic. It's still happening and it's just after World War One. It's just like, fucking hell, I'd rather you went out fighting.
Yeah. How many times do you have to be poisoned before you stop petting the snake?
Well, like DiCaprio in this, really. There's a point in this film where you know he knows what he's doing to his wife and he continues to do it.
Yeah, he becomes complicit, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it's like, I want to reach in that screen and punch your buck teeth, motherfucker.
Yeah, I think you're meant to. I think you are meant to want that. For old Ernest, he's meant to be a bit of a, but yeah, I do, and I'm listen. You know a lot more about history in general than I do, so I fully appreciate and respect what you say. I don't have anything to add because I wouldn't know what it is I'm saying.
Just read that book. Maybe it's a great book.
Maybe I will. Got any more dislikes for me?
That's it, Dad.
That's all you done.
That's it, Dad.
Now, my second dislike, we have touched on it, but I've got it written down, so I'm going to say it anyway, just to expand on it a bit more. And for me, again, despite what Mr. Quaron said, despite what you said, for me, it just didn't feel like it was the right narrative. Killers of the Flower Moon tells the story and struggle with the Osage people being murdered for their inherited money and assets. Yet, like we've already touched on, the story is mainly told from the perspective of one of those responsible for taking advantage of the indigenous people. Surely a film like this should be seen from the perspective of those who are being targeted and victimised. Now, you praised Lily Gladstone, and I'm right there with you. She seems like a capable actor who could have handled carrying more of the film. But it felt like it was a creative decision to give most of the heavy lifting to the film's most established actors, Mr. De Niro and Mr. DiCaprio. And that in itself felt like an odd injustice. This is an Osage story and it should have been told from an Osage standpoint. Again, fully, I hold my hands up. If I am guilty of watching this incorrectly, then that's me. I've done wrong. I'm the bad man. But I've seen it three times and that sense of this doesn't feel right. This feels like it's through the lens of the wrong camera. It needs to be from their perspective.
Well, what does Scorsese know so well? What does he write so well? Criminals.
Mm.
He writes the dark characters.
Yeah.
He understands, he probably knows the ins and outs of gangsters. I mean, the whole story in Goodfellas, you know, it's based on a true story. It's biographical. He knows the ins and outs of how criminal minds work and how they scheme and stuff. So I think he went with his biggest strength and wanted to do it from that perspective.
Yeah.
I know some people that have read the book, the original book of Killers of the Flower Moon, say that they should have showed more of their J. Edgar Hoover influence with the case because it was really interesting, apparently.
I'm sure it was, yeah.
About how, was he doing it for the right reasons, or was he doing it to just get publicity for the FBI to try and make him a respected police force? So I don't know. I think he played to his strengths, and we saw it from a criminal perspective, which for me and you sounds like probably apologizing. Actually, we're championing Lily Gladstone, and the story should have been told from the Native Indian perspective.
Yeah, despite what Alfonso Cuarón said, Alfie to me, I still can't help, and that's after three watches, I still can't help but like, I kind of wanted to see more Gladstone.
But then again, you did say earlier, and it was actually a really good point.
Chief Standing Bear?
Well, no, look, it was told from a perspective probably to shock us about how casual it is to murder people.
Yeah, and I mean, your point supports it as well. If someone said to us before we knew this was a film, they put this on and said, watch this film, I think within 20 minutes... we'd be like, Scorsese directed this.
We can't pick a lane, can we?
No, we can't.
We can't pick a lane.
No, and we won't.
Do you know why it's called Flower Moon?
They explain it in the film, do they not?
I don't know. But I know Native Indians, they call it the Flower Moon because when that moon comes out in May time, all the flowers are in blossom on the steppe, on the hills. So they call it the Flower Moon. I thought it's so pretty.
It's nice.
So pretty. What a beautiful culture.
What would you rather see? Flower that's the size of a moon, or flowers that are the size, or that moons are the size of flowers.
Moons are the size of, that's the same thing, bro.
No, so flowers, if you look up at the sky and it's one massive fuck off flower, and then you look at like flowers
like
in
the sun
field
in Teletubbies.
No, but a flower.
The moon.
And then you look at a field full of flowers, and they're all tiny little moons.
I'll keep it as it is, I think. I'm quite sure that we've just all got accustomed to how it looks. If I woke up at night, there was a huge fucking sunflower in the sky.
Ooh.
I'd be so weirded out.
Is that a what the plot idea that we need to make a note of?
And little tiny moons.
If there was a bouquet of moons, I can't say I wouldn't try and eat it.
Wait, is that because of Wallace and Gromit, because they think it's made of cheese?
I've always thought the moon's oddly edible.
Tasty.
Yeah.
Take a little bite out of it.
Mm.
Spread that shit on a cracker. Busan Moon. Busan Moon.
Busan Moon. I'll go on to my final dislike, and I'm surprised it's one that you didn't share. Because I, when I saw this part of the film and I disliked it, I thought you'd be there with me.
I was too busy wiping my ass.
Okay. And that's the Scorsese segment. I love Mr. Scorsese, but I wasn't a fan of him wrapping his film up by narrating the fates of those involved. I thought the wrapping up part itself of the film was quite clever. Playing out the conclusion to an audience was a smart move.
That's like an Orson Welles one.
Yeah.
With all the sound effects.
Yeah, and that's one that I haven't seen before. But I'd have preferred it if Marty stayed behind the camera. I found it distracting and felt like it was another misstep from a man that doesn't usually make any. And again, this could be another case of someone getting to the latter stages of life and thinking, I wish I'd done a bit more acting. Or, no, fuck it, I'm Martin motherfucking Scorsese. I'm going to put myself in the film.
I didn't like it, but I also don't know the reasons why he done it. So without knowing why he did it, it's hard for me. I mean, I don't like it. I've never liked it. I hate it. M. Night Shyamalan, when he does it, even though I always found his first three films really compelling, fun films to watch at the cinema, great little 1.5 hour throwaway films, when he puts himself in his films, it cheapens the film. It cheapens the whole experience for me.
I never had a problem with it. And then you brought it up once. Mm. And we've spent so much time together that when I see it in a film now, I've kind of inherited your dislike for it. Because you're right. Unless they're like already a really good established actor that have gone into directing, and there's a part that they're really good at within the film, you're like, well, okay, you're a great actor, so of course you're going to be in it. Like, I get it. But when it's someone like Tarantino, Scorsese, Shyamalan, it just lessens it. Like at the end, like you had the guy that was already doing the story was doing a grand job. Like I don't understand why Scorsese, unless it was sort of like this is a passion project of mine. Like I want to deliver like how like this was such a important moment for the FBI, such an important moment for the Osage people, such an important American moment in history. Like I want to finalize it by being like it wasn't even mentioned on her death. Like these atrocities have been long forgotten. Like maybe that was what he was going for, but for me it didn't land.
You've done it, man. He did it all wrong. You're right.
Yeah.
Do you know how I see this now?
Go.
This should have been a three-part miniseries. And it's, you know when Band of Brothers used to start? And
fuck,
you'd get the real veterans of a black screen behind them just telling you the story, and then the music for Band of Brothers would start and the episode would start. Scorsese should have spoke at the start of each episode, maybe, and Tall Standing Bear Man. I totally disrespected the Osage there because I didn't get his name.
Chief Standing Bear, I believe.
Chief Standing Bear. They should have had them sort of people talk at the start with a black screen behind them and then do the episodes. Go and undo your film.
Yep.
Split it into three.
Stop. Hold the press. Hold. Scorsese.
Yep.
Don't release it yet.
Don't.
Don't. Ah. Oh.
He did, though.
Oh, fuck.
That's how we saw it.
That's probably how we saw it.
Shit.
That's interesting, though, because one of my original questions was, do you think Killers of the Flower Moon would be better as a limited series? Because
yes.
I thought exactly the same.
Yes.
And but I thought for the question segment, the answer would be too quick, because I think it would just be like, yes.
Yeah, because I think series are excellent at establishing atmosphere because the narrative runs a little slower.
You could have spent more time with characters.
You can, and you can do that in a series. That's why miniseries are, you know, I adore them, love them. You give me a little 10-episode one-off series, I have enough time to be invested in everything. Obviously, expense runs high. But yeah, I do believe I probably would have enjoyed it more.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it more. But God, people are going to go nuts. I think a lot of people love this movie.
Well,
I'm not saying I don't enjoy aspects of it.
I liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. I think I'd have liked it more if it was a bit tighter. I think I'd have loved it even more if the narrative was, I mean, it's not top tier for Scorsese for me, but if you hate it and you want to fight us, get in touch. We welcome any correspondence, any communications. We'll take anything.
Yep.
Yeah. Even if it's just an FU.
Yep.
We'll take it.
Just sweetly packaged finger up the arse.
Yep. Happily oblige.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some questions.
Ah.
What are your top three Scorsese films?
Oof. Goodfellas.
Yep.
Silence. Oh, fuck it. I'm going to say it. Gangs of New York.
Oh.
I just enjoy it. It's Cameron in it and DiCaprio are some of the weakest parts in the film.
Yeah.
But Day-Lewis's character, Builder Butch, was one of the finest bad guys in cinema history. And it's a great film. Visual feast. Fun.
You got some great supporting cast in that as well, though.
Brilliant.
Liam Neeson.
Stephen Graham.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah. John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
Look at us just throwing, we're just spitting.
Bosch.
I could look at you all day.
Boof. I've run out of names, I think.
Mm.
That's good. They're free. I was tempted by Silence.
I potentially forgot.
Yeah.
Loads of Goodfellas.
Well, my top three, I mean, Goodfellas has to be there. That's the star on the Scorsese Christmas tree as far as I'm concerned.
Excellently paced film.
Yeah. Superb. I'd go Goodfellas, The Departed, last Jack
Departed.
Nicholson film.
Another one, another great one.
Top dog. And The King of Comedy. I loved that film.
Mm.
It walked so Joker could run.
I've never seen it.
Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah, never good. Seen it.
I don't know if because you've seen Joker, for me, I saw Joker, then I watched King of Comedy, and I'm like, oh, Joker did just steal its whole premise from The King of Comedy, but it's great. De Niro at his best. I think it's oddly underrated.
Then again, is there not, without me seeing it, obviously I could be reaching, but is there not parallels between a clown and, say, someone who wants to do stand-up? So they're already some form of performance in there.
Well, you're fighting for people's attention, aren't you?
Yeah. But, you know, you're going to... I know a lot. Philip's got a lot of hate for it, but a lot of film directors show their influences.
Yeah.
Loads of them. Look at Inception with Paprika.
I mean, if I didn't watch Joker, and I know a lot of people despise that film. Personally, I'll die on the hill of saying that I really enjoyed it. I don't know. People were like, oh, you're a toxic man. You like it. Me. But I think it's a good film. If I hadn't have seen that, I don't know if I'd have been in a rush to watch The King of Comedy. So there is value in that, in new films taking a great deal from an old film, and it almost spikes the interest of the film that it's taken so much from.
So what happens then? Does Todd Phillips say, wouldn't it be funny if it was like King of Comedy, but rather than being actually funny, he's awful, he bombs on stage?
Yeah.
Because you only see one bit of stand-up in it. In King of Comedy, is the stand-up quite prolific?
I think he's struggling to get a platform. If I remember, it's been a few years since I've seen The King of Comedy. I watched it quite soon after I saw Joker at the cinema. He's struggling to get a platform. So he sort of takes someone who can get him on stage hostage almost, and then he gets a chance to shine. And guess what? He's actually a fucking good comedian, whereas Joker subverts it. He's awful. He's not a comedian. He's a fucking maniac. Like, and that's through being a product of his environment and experiences.
Sounds like a very small part of the film is King of Comedy then.
Yeah.
In terms of Joker. I mean, sounds like a small segment.
I mean, there's certain scenes that you can tell is taken from it. But for me, you know, we've
when he washes his mum's back pussy in the bath.
Hey?
That scene. Do you remember that in Joker?
There's none of that.
He washes his mummy, didn't he?
Yeah, but I don't recall that being in the King of Comedy.
Okay.
I don't think so anyway.
Okay.
You threw me there with that term. Was not expecting a back pussy.
Just means bum.
Yeah.
Bum bum.
Yeah, yeah.
Keister.
Yep. Keister from...
Another sister.
Sister.
Oh, don't go back to the sisters.
Yeah. No, too soon.
Nah.
What is your favourite film over 3 hours long?
Oh, that's tough, you know. I do love Dances of Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Really enjoyed Dances of Wolves. JFK potentially might be over 3 hours. I couldn't give you the specific runtime. I love Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm.
Love Bridge on a River Quiet.
Mm.
But I know, obviously, they're different to watch now. But I still adore them. Gladiator. Really enjoyable. I think that's 3 hours.
Is it?
Potentially. I think it could be 3 hours. Really enjoyed The Irishman. I mean, there's a lot. I'd have to look at the runtime. Some of these might be 2 hour 45.
Yeah, that's near enough, isn't it?
So who knows that?
People's do knows.
Yeah, Silence. I don't know.
That's a long dog.
Interstellar.
Yeah. Is that free? You're right. There's so many films that sort of flirt with that.
Just shy.
3 hours. And like I said earlier in the episode, I haven't always been a fan of long slow burns, but now I love me some lovely long length.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I know that sometimes a good old long film, one that I've seen recently that's, it's not necessarily my favourite film over 3 hours, but because it's recent and fresh in thy mem, Babylon, I thought was brilliant. And I know, again, loads of people...
An ode to cinema.
Yeah, loads of people are overtly eggy about that film. But for me, I thought it was great. I was gripped. And when a film is a 3 hours plus, and not once you're going... Fuck me, I'm not even halfway through yet. Not once you're not checking your watch.
You enjoy it more than Flower Moon?
I'd go out and say it, yeah. Come for thy.
That's good. I think there's nothing wrong with saying that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I prefer Lawrence of Arabia to Flower Moon.
Mm.
I mean, I can't get over them opening shots with the dunes and the music. It's just magical. It takes me.
I prefer Toy Story to Killers of the Flower Moon.
That is not 3 hours long.
But I just... wanted to say I really like Toy Story.
Babylon, I have to check that dog out.
Yeah, I think you'd dig it. I think you'd be in my camp with that one, I reckon. I feel
can you dig it? Remember that in The Warriors? You didn't see it?
I seen it many years ago.
Okay.
I only remember small snippets of that film.
Easy there, Warriors.
Is it worth
all the way back to Coney Island?
Do you reckon it's held up?
It never did when it was first made.
Fair enough.
It was just brilliant from the get-go. You're taken in instantly by leather, what's it called when you put over a suit? What's the thing?
Without arm?
Waistcoat.
Yeah.
Leather waistcoats, no shirts in rainy, cold New York. From the get-go, if you're not in, you never bought a ticket. You had no chance.
Which other historical injustice would you like to see a feature-length film about?
I wouldn't know. I don't think I remember the guy's name, but potentially, is it Peter Sharp? Something Sharp. It was an English teacher who climbed Everest in the 2000s. And there's an infamous cave, not cave, but a little like cliff dent on Everest called Green Boots Cave, where a Pakistani climber died years before. And it's called Green Boots Cave because it's the only thing you can see is his boots and they're green.
Oh.
And this English teacher... he took cover under there. He started getting the hypoxia or whatever it is, where the altitude, basically your brain starved of oxygen. Oh. You start to slowly die, hypothermia. And something like 60 walkers walked past him and they wanted to just go to the top and down. Obviously, if you're above 8,000 in the death zone, it's almost impossible to save someone. But after seeing this man dying and slowly shivering in a cave... I think there's a guy called Mark Illis or Innes. I can't remember his name. Sorry for all this butchery of names. But he was a double amputee and he wanted to be the first double amputee to summit Everest. And one of his team was one of many teams that walked past him and just wanted to climb Everest. If I saw a man dying...
Wait, hold up.
I'd do my best to help.
People saw him struggle and didn't help him.
Well, they some would stop and like look at him, and he was breathing and stuff, and they would just look at him and they'd be like, there's nothing I can really do for him, and they'd carry on with the hike. But in my head, fuck, I'd be like, what is the point in having what could potentially be the happiest moment of my life, which I will only ever remember now for watching a poor British school teacher who was solo hiking to. He's a bit of an idiot. But yeah, I think he did he have supplemental oxygen? Probably not. But still, they all walked past him. And it could be a really good film into morals and, you know, how far would you go just to say, oh, I've climbed Everest? Well, well done. You're the one of, what, 2,000 plus people now that have climbed it?
I can't believe they just saw someone, not even a, you're right, mate. I mean, was he easy to reach or was it just...
I think some people definitely... looked at him, moved a bit closer and felt for a pulse, and he had a pulse and stuff. But then it's like, well, you know, in their mind, they're like, most people die coming down a mountain. So to try and help someone down a mountain, but there's cases where it has been achieved. It has been done.
So did he just die there?
They just left him there to die there.
That is.
And he did die there. He never got out of Green Boots Cave.
I want to see, what would you call that film? Green Boots Cave?
It would be a good name because it stands out.
Yeah.
Green Boots Cave. But yeah, something like that, or Death on the Mountain, or Ain't No Mountain High Enough.
Ooh.
Oh, shit.
Piss Poor Pedestrians.
Piss Poor Pedestrians.
Not really a pedestrian if you're climbing a motherfucking mountain, though, I suppose.
Double Amp Your Greed. Holy shit.
You done it.
There you go.
You did it.
There you go.
That's fucking tragic. Mm. Like, imagine living with that as well.
Mm.
Like, oh, how was Everest? I was amazing. I did it. And then always, whenever you think about that, you would be like, should have maybe tried to help that guy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you'd ever forget. And then especially like, so obviously this is a story that's being told now. People know that he died there. Imagine hearing about that and then being like, I saw that guy. Mm. I ignored it.
Then again, though, like Nando Prada said about the Andes, he says, you know, we're not rock climbers. We didn't put ourselves in that place. Mm. It was out of our control. So there's a part of me that also is a bit like, well, that guy knew exactly what he was doing. When you hike your ass up a mountain and you pay for the cheapest tour guides and no Sherpas and you die in a cave up there, you knew full well going up there that you might die. So is it a tragedy? Who knows?
You put yourself there.
Yeah, you did put yourself there. You put yourself in harm's way and you died from it. It's like the guy who lost his arm on a boulder wanking. Wait, was he wanking and then the boulder fell on his arm?
I don't
127 hours.
Yeah, I feel like you've thrown in the wank.
He did have a wank.
No, I'm sure.
He did. He rubbed one out when his arm was caught, wasn't it?
I don't.
He was thinking about birds and stuff because he thought he was dying, so he rubbed one out. He did. He man-milked right where he was, and then he took his arm off, chopped his arm off. He did.
Have you seen the film?
Nah.
So it's pure speculation.
No, I watched a documentary.
It's what... So his arm didn't get caught because he paused the climb to pop a wank off?
No, well, I didn't know that part. That's why I'm asking. But I know that he rubbed one out in his before the 127 hours was up. It might have been at the second hour that he was caught.
You're trapped.
2 hours.
You give yourself a tight 120.
Yep.
And then you're like, may as well.
Yeah.
2 hours.
2 hours.
And just then
the
2 hours.
And
I mean,
the next 160 saint.
You have 125 hours left.
Yeah.
So within the first 2 hours.
Yeah, because...
Less time than this fucking film.
You could move into an area of pain which doesn't allow you to reach full climax.
I'm sorry, but 2 hours in, I'm still trying to escape. I'm not going, well, I'm going to have a go.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Well, he was in a huge crack.
Hello. Maybe that's all he needed. What would you rate Killers of the Flower Moon out of 10, please?
6.5 out of 10.
Okay. I mean, that tracks.
Do you want me to ask you what you rate it?
No, I was doing maths because I've got a 0.5 in there and you know how that makes me stumble.
You gave this 0.5? Jesus. That's 7, mate.
I'm still struggling with the maths here.
Well, what did you give it? Tell me and I'll help you. Beautiful mind. Say it.
I'd give it 7.5 out of 10. So I've gone a bit higher.
I actually can't figure that out.
Well, I have figured it out now. People
13.5.
People who are the most basic math skills are sitting there going, you two are fucking idiots.
Dude, you can't even say that's basic math skill. That's
less than basic.
That's
primary school.
DiCaprio in this film.
Yeah. So yeah, for the reasons I stated earlier, my love of Scorsese, De Niro, DiCaprio, the look, the feel, all of those things, like I did greatly enjoy escaping into it. It's not top level Scorsese for me. At the time of recording, we now know that it's been nominated for quite a lot of Oscars. Mm. I'd be the one that I reckon it's got most likelihood of winning would be Lily Gladstone in the best female actor role. I don't see it winning Best Picture, but I didn't think last year that Everything Everywhere All at Once would win. So
hell,
I have no idea. I have no idea. It may well sweep up. But yeah, I'd go a bit higher at 7.5. That gives Killers of the Flower Moon a total score of 14 out of 20. If you like your true stories to be loaded, lovely to look at, and longer than a flight from London Gatwick to Malta, or if you've ever wanted to digest a dim-witted DiCaprio doing dastardly deeds to some indigenous dudes and dudettes, then Killers of the Flower Moon could be a film for you. Killers of the Flower Moon is available to stream on Apple TV+. Consider watching this one if you enjoyed There Will Be Blood, Dances with Wolves, and Hostiles. Should we play a game?
Give it a name, give it a name, give it a name now. We birth a plot and then make a trailer. What the plot?
Action!
Okay, my turn today. I'm going to do a little quote for you and give you a little insight.
Our Billy wasn't born a criminal, Clarice. He was made one through years of systematic abuse.
I want an origin story for Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. And his real character's name in the book or the film, if you watch it, is James Gunn. And he was born in 1948, California. Now, there is something I do want to say to you. So the film decided to keep James Gunn's Buffalo Bill, aka Buffalo Bill's backstory, out of the script. But in the book, you find out his backstory. Now, if you watch Silence of the Lambs and you want an origin story on Buffalo Bill, you can alter his past, because in Silence of the Lambs, they don't bring it up. Or I can tell you what Thomas Harris wrote about Gum's backstory.
I would like to hear Gum's backstory.
Okay, Gum's backstory, aka Buffalo Bill, is written as such in the book. Gum was born in California in 1948 or 49. It is stated that the Jame on his birth certificate apparently was a clerical error that no one bothered to correct. Gum's mother, an aspiring actress, went into an alcoholic decline after her career failed to materialise, and Los Angeles County placed Gum in a foster home when he was 2. The novel goes on to tell of Gum living in foster homes until the age of 10, when he is adopted by his grandparents, who become his first victims when he impulsively kills them at the age of 12. That's very Kemper, isn't it? He did that. He is institutionalized in Tulare Vocational Rehabilitation, a psychiatric hospital where he learns to be a tailor, i.e., he's good at making human suit. Later, Gum has a relationship with Benjamin Raspill. After Raspill leaves him, he kills Raspill's new lover, Klaus, and flays him. So that's what Thomas Harris wrote in the book. But in the film, they masterfully don't even need to tell you that. You watch the film, you know the guy's fucked up. You could have filled in then gaps on your own. So if you're going to do a true origin story prequel to Silence of the Lambs, you can alter Thomas Harris's text on his past. Or you could stick to what he just wrote, you know. Going to foster care because his mum was an alcoholic, killing his own grandparents. He learnt to be a tailor. So obviously the backstory can be as per Thomas Harris, and we do an origin story and we see him almost like what they did with that Dharma series, or a film where we explore Buffalo Bill. And how I think the Thomas Harris universe, the place he created of all his characters,
yeah,
Lecter and Clarice and the killers within it, fascinating. I think you could explore it a lot more. But yeah, I'd love to see an origin story of Buffalo Bill.
I mean, he is one hell of a dark dude.
Mm.
And a fascinating character within the film. I'm struggling to think of a young actor that would do him justice. I know the actor, I can see his face. I can't remember his name.
Ted Levine did the original.
Yeah.
Who did? He was excellent.
who did the Silence of the Lambs one?
Ted Levine played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. Oh, was she real fat, lady?
Yeah.
It's so pop culture now. It's ingrained in pop culture, the rub your lotion on your skin or else you get the hose again, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. But imagine his backstory. It'd be brilliant.
Do you, out of interest, like, I would love to see this film. Like, there's seen a surge of in cinema about sort of antagonists and villains given, like, an origin story to learn more about them in recent years. Do you have anyone in mind for the casting? Because I can't think of a younger actor that looks like Ted Levine.
Maybe a Skarsgård.
Ooh.
But he's the clown in it, isn't he? Or maybe one of the young lads from Dunkirk. Tom Glyn Carney. He's good. He's a very charming, handsome young actor.
Yeah.
You know, he's the lad on one of the rescue boats with his dad. He's on the same boat as Keown.
Yes. I haven't seen that. It rings a bell. I haven't seen it for so long. I do have
that
one.
That guy. I'm showing Adam with my screen.
Is he a bit too handsome?
I mean, he's very handsome.
He's a handsome dude.
I don't think that probably could have happened.
I have one idea.
Jesse Plemons. No, he's still too old.
I have one idea for casting to play good old Buffalo Bill.
Mm.
And it's Keir Gilchrist.
Who that?
Look him up. K-E-I-R. G-I-L-C-H-R-A-I-S-T. He's from Atypical. It's kind of a funny story. It follows.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's 31, but he's a young-looking guy.
He looks young.
And I think, like, he could play that sort of troubled younger person.
So it follows.
Yeah. I could see him playing. He's a great actor. He's fantastic in Atypical. I'd like to see him in more things, especially in a leading role. And this would be really challenging for him, like a character that I've never seen him portray.
That's well casted, because he would definitely play a kid who looks weak in the start of his life.
Yeah. And I think I'm struggling. And as you were speaking and giving me a major what the plot synopsis, that was incredible, by the way, that he's someone that sprung to mind. I was like, I could see him.
Mm.
He's got a slight resemblance of Ted Levine. So I think I'd go with him.
It's the mouth. I see it now.
And I reckon he could be quite troubling. And that is a film I would watch.
It would be a shocking film, because to go through foster homes, and like Hannibal says,
yeah,
he didn't become a criminal. He was made one through years of systematic abuse. You're watching a film about that.
Yeah.
That is rough. Oh, don't put that. Oh, no, I'm not going to say it.
Okay. Yeah, good. Because I don't know what you was going to say then. So this is a thriller. It'd have to be a dark film. Would it be too on the nose to go for Jonathan Demme? Is he still alive? Is he still floating about?
I don't know if he's still alive. And for some strange reason, I've started to use the computer randomly in season 2, episode whatever this is.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have a look.
No, do it, because it's helping us.
Is Jonathan Demme still alive?
He obviously done a great job with...
He died 26 April 2017.
Okay, well, we'll go with someone different then. That's fine. You got any ideas?
Lars von Trier.
Mm.
Only for the grotesque bits.
Mm.
When it comes to storytelling or framing a shot, he ain't shit.
Yeah.
No, don't use him.
That's what
I was going to say.
I'm going to go tried and tested, Denis Villeneuve.
Oh, yes.
Because he's handled already existing... intellectual property with Blade Runner.
Incendi.
With Dune. Like, mm-hmm. he's you know, you can rely on him with the franchise, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think he'd be able to handle an established character and do a good job of it. It's important that the film wouldn't be a glamorization of a villain, more of a deep study into why Buffalo Bill became who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be a straight up drama with Villeneuve at the helm.
And it's cool to think as well, in this film, he cannot be called Buffalo Bill, because he is only Buffalo Bill when he starts killing in Silence of the Lambs. And his real name's James Gum. The character's real name's James Gum.
Gum.
James Gum. Isn't it weird? It's like
not James.
You left the I out of Jamie or something, but you've got James.
Yeah.
James Gum, as in gums. If you didn't get that.
Yeah.
But he can't be Buffalo Bill.
But I'm tempted to still call the film just Bill.
Would you?
Because everybody knows Buffalo Bill. And it's how he becomes Bill. Becoming Bill's too on the nose. It sounds like it could be like a fucking rom-com or something.
Becoming Bill sounds like a neighbourly sitcom from 60s Surbiton, yeah. England.
But it's Becoming Bill.
Yeah. Yeah, no one wants to see that.
Put the kettle on, love. It's Becoming Bill.
Yeah, no one wants to see that.
Sorry.
No, I like that. So I think I would just call this film directed by Denis Villeneuve and starring Keir Gilchrist, and I think I would just call it Bill.
Look at him, Starling. Tell me what you see.
Monster isn't born. He is created.
Well, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups.
My mother, she didn't love me. Guess what? I didn't love my mother.
He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment. What he does with them takes privacy.
It only started with my grandparents. Cause mommy, she wasn't home.
He's in his 30s or 40s. He's got real physical strength.
I will transcend. I will transform.
And he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
Will you come with me? I'd come with me.